Eyes Radio. Thank you for tuning in to our program. My name is Henrik Palmgren, and our website is redeyescreations.com. Go there. We have a free radio archive with over a year of good stuff up there for you to dig into. When you've done with that, if you're not yet a member on our website, you can subscribe and get full access to our radio and video archives. And don't forget to follow along in our very busy news section. We have our news RSS feed up and running now. We've started a Red Eyes Twitter feed, so you can follow us from your cell or a mobile. And also take a look at our two different YouTube channels, one for video and one for our radio show. And again, you'll find all this information on redeyescreations.com. And today we are going to talk about the legacy of the Etruscans and the spirit of Portland. We have Gary Biltcliffe with us, who have been researching ancient cultures, civilizations, and megalithic sites from around the world. Gary has a video presentation available on the web that goes into this mystery and little-known topic of the Etruscans, the pre-Roman people in the region that we now call Italy, around Tuscany primarily. Gary is also the author of a book called The Spirit of Portland. His website is belusinline.com, where you can find more information about his research, his books, and much more. So with that, welcome to the program, Gary, and thank you for coming on Red Eyes Radio.
Thank you. Thank you. Nice to meet you.
It's very nice to have you on the program. As I mentioned at the beginning here, I saw your lecture a while back in regards to the Etruscan and Etruscans, and was really, really impressed and almost floored about some of the information that you managed to dig up. I've heard so little about the Etruscan people, and you don't hear so much about them. You always hear about the Romans, of course, and what they've been doing.
Absolutely.
But this is so little known. But Gary, before we dive into mainly talking about the Etruscans, give our audience a little bit of background in regards to yourself and when you began researching megalithic mm-hmm. sites, ancient cultures, and how your interest began in this.
Okay. Well, I was brought up in the north of England near the Lake District, which is a bit like Sweden, I guess. And it was while I was a young child, I was always drawn to ancient sites, ruins, churches. I just felt good at these places, and I didn't realize why then. I just naturally felt drawn to them. And I suppose as I grew older, I became more attuned to these places, and I became fascinated with them, the ancient Egyptians, the Greeks. I don't know why. Maybe I have some other connection that I can't explain. But while I was a teenager, I began to explore other countries and look at ancient sites in all over the world, really, in North America, South America, Mexico, Peru, around Europe. And then I moved down to the south of England, became fascinated with the megalithic sites in our country, so Stonehenge, Avebury, and the many stone circles around the country. And I was given inspiration from them, and sometimes ideas about the people who built them. And it was while I was on a holiday in Italy that I came across some of the magnificent megalithic walls around so-called Roman sites. Mm. That I recognized were far older because of their weathering, and the sheer size and construction manner is superior to the Romans.
And I guess what we can say also as well is that a lot of sites and things like that has been attributed to the Romans, or at least they themselves seem to say, yes, or propose that a lot of these sites actually are Roman. There's even places in Baalbek, I think, in Syria, where they claim that the Romans have built it. But again, some of these megalithic, you know, sites are goes way, way much, yes, more long back into history. Isn't that right?
Yes. Can I say that, you know, anybody who explores Europe and looks at Roman sites will see, you know, a typical fashion of mortaring, rubble infill, squared out of stones. In this country, in Europe, Roman remains are easily recognized. But when you see these great megalithic walls with, you know, angles that are cut and they fit together, you can't pass a blade between them, and some of the stones weighing several tons, It's nothing like the Romans. It's just an observation, a simple observation.
Exactly. There's a few different sites that we can talk about later on here, which I guess you've you kind of tie this together, that it was actually the Etruscans behind them. But mm-hmm. give us a little bit of a guess, I guess, the official story of the Etruscans first. What time period were they around, and primarily in what region were they in?
Well, I mean, this is another shady area as well, because, you know, Etruscan specialists, you know, they generally agree that they began around the sort of 9th century BC and disappeared around the 3rd century BC when the Romans basically annihilated them and absorbed them into their culture. But the ancestors of the Etruscans, you know, go back way up to the 3000 BC in that area, all the way through the Iron Age, up to the time when the Etruscan civilization suddenly appeared. But I think the Etruscans really they call them the Etruscans, but really because there are people from that area of Etruria, which is today Tuscany and Lazio.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, when the Etruscan cities suddenly appeared, they seem to be made from an amalgamation of different cultures, not just Italian, but a bit of Greek, possibly Trojan, if people believe in the Trojan culture. And Eastern influences as well. So I think my theory was that the Etruscan civilization was born out of a fusion of different races who settled in that wonderful area of Tuscany, which to me is probably the best landscape to live in those days, because it had the most fertile soil from the volcanic mountains. It had the best sort of temperature for people to live in, and the food that grows there, as anyone who's been there will vouch for, that is probably the most delicious in the world. Mm. In fact, the Tuscany soil is probably the most fertile soil in Europe. But I think it's a natural place for people to assemble or go to. You know,
that's interesting. What would you think would be the cause for people to get together like that? Do you think that there's something else behind that? I mean. In many cases, civilizations and people seem to kind of stick to their own place, so to speak. But it seems to me that something happened in the past which brought these people together and they settled in a new area. What do you think, Gary?
I think, you know, natural disasters that are not very well reported in our histories have occurred. That's, you know, related to famines, possibly near comets disasters. Like that caused the end of the Neolithic Age, the end of the Bronze Age. They're all sort of now, they're working out that, you know, these time periods, there was, a possible volcanic and cataclysms around the world. So I think tribes moved around in those days after these famines or times where there was a volcanic eruptions and the clouds sort of covered that area for so long, crops wouldn't grow, so they had to move. So I think it's more to do with natural disasters that moved people around in those days.
Mm.
But I believe today, you know, the Earth is more stable than it's ever been. If you're a historian, look through history carefully, you'll see that it's the Earth has been littered with natural disasters in the past, but very few today. So.
Mm. That's interesting. You mentioned a bit in your lecture about that the Etruscans was the possible founders of Rome as well. I guess that they had a huge city area in that region, and later on the Romans, and we can talk about the Romans later on as well, where they came from and so forth. But
that's right.
In regards to Rome, do you think the Etruscans built that, or were the originators of it?
Yes, one of the kings of Tarquinia, which was the main city of the Etruscans, actually went down into the Roman areas. The Romans then were just a tribe of people living in mud huts around the 4th, 5th century BC. And the Etruscans were living in great palaces of marble and stone. So the king of Etruria, I think his name is Tarquin, Tarquin is a superbus, he basically taught the Romans, the primitive Romans, how to irrigate, how to farm, how to build cities, and taught them how to move the water and make aqueducts, viaducts. And basically, over a period of a couple of hundred years, Rome became a great city. But it was built with the knowledge and the ingenuity of Etruscan engineers. So basically, the Etruscans taught the Romans everything, even building roads. But unfortunately, the Romans, being warlike, and the Etruscans were not, that sealed their fate in a way, because the Etruscans basically were slaves to their priests and soothsayers. They were very, very highly religious people who didn't really go out to war. And basically, everything they did had to go through their soothsayers, their priests, who divined, you know, the will of the gods, basically, through the clap of thunder or the flight of a bird. So when the Romans did start to get greedy and want to take and expand their territory, and the Etruscans didn't really know what to do, and the right messages weren't coming from their priests, and so they didn't immobilize an army very quickly, So they were laid open, really, and I think that was the downfall of their culture.
That is interesting. So they're taken over by their the people that they tutor, yes, so to speak. That's kind of interesting. So in regards to their, if we talk a little bit about their religion, as you mentioned, again, today we know that there's a lot of, there have been found underneath Rome certain types of pre-civilization discoveries relation to Mithraism and the Romulus and Remus story and all this stuff. Do you think that those mythologies can have something to do with the Etruscans, or did they have a total other set of gods and goddesses?
Yes, they did. The Etruscans had nothing in common with the Romans. Their religion was taught to them by a mysterious being. This is the actual foundation myth of the Etruscans, is that while one of the farmers was ploughing the field, out of a hole in the ground came a small man. They called him he was small in body but large in head, and taught them the rules of their religion. And this man actually was called Tarkan, and he taught this other man this new religion, and he then passed it on to all the people around there, and soon Tarquinia, the greatest city, was built on the sort of knowledge from this little being that came from inner earth. And this is all written down by the Romans, so I mean, it may just be a myth, but it's shrouded in mystery. The Etruscan religion seemed to just appear. Now they do have parallels with the British Druids and the European Druids. I mean, the Druids themselves also, you know, scrutinize a sheep liver as they did, basically saw in nature signs that they would determine an action. Like we would cast the runes today, you know, or divination.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if we talk about the Etruscans again, you say that they just seem to appear out of nowhere. We have this possibility that we have some kind of earth changes, which means that a few different cultures are coming together. But more than that, is there anything more specific you can go into? Do you think that they really were more of Celtic or Druidic origin, or did they come from another region primarily? What can you say about that?
Well, from my experience of traveling around all the Etruscan cities and seeing their great tombs and paintings, you see a mix of races. You see dark-skinned people, red-haired people, blonde-haired people. You see the typical Italian-Greek type people. It's like I was saying before, it feels to me there's a fusion. But a clue comes from some of the local people who still live in the mountainous areas of Tuscany today, still maintain that their great ancestors came over the mountains from the north. Well, I've been looking through sort of Celtic literature, and I found that the Cymry were an ancient race who came and settled in Wales, in Britain, all the way from the Black Sea areas during the sort of the late Bronze Age, and that their actual journey was recorded. And it says in this journey from an area of Istanbul that they crossed the Italian mountains, but a group of them stayed in the mountains and came south into Etruria.
Okay.
So there's a crew, maybe a crew there in some of our ancient traditions that the Catholic Church has failed to destroy, that, you know, these people may have been the ancient Cymry, who were related to people who may, you know, have come from Sumeria or Egypt and crossed overland.
Interesting. How do you spell Cymry, by the way?
Well, it's the sound is with a sharp K as a K, but it's actually written with a C, a soft C, if you like, C Y M R Y.
Okay.
But the K is pronounced with a hard K, if you like, so as Cymry. Or some people call them, like the Sumerians, they're actually known as the Cymrians, but they're all related. They're all the early Celtic tribes.
Hmm.
And but there are certain Celtic influences. The Etruscan language, for instance, is another isolated case. They've never really managed to decipher their written language, and it has sort of parallels to the runes, the Nordic runes.
Really, now that is really interesting. How do you think that have happened, so to speak?
Well, I think, you know, there was probably one language throughout Europe at some stage or another that may have been related to the Futhark or the sort of Saxon runic script.
Mm-hmm.
And but that language, you know, was wiped out with later cultures and it's disappeared. But we find remnants of it. Historians found remnants of it all in different places around the world. And it's still a mystery, really. But I think it's possible that a race from the north, or maybe Northern Europe, settled in Etruria along with the native inhabitants, and they somehow settled peacefully together and merged their cultures.
Hmm.
And I think this explains to me why there was a great fusion happened here, and the great cities were built in a short amount of time. And within 100 years, from a plain landscape, we had palaces, roads, aqueducts, canals. The mystery is the stone masons that the Etruscans used. Now, I always think the knowledge is always carried through stone masons throughout history. And I think these great walls were built by what I call the Pelasgi, because the Pelasgi were also supposed to have settled with the Etruscans and became part of the Etruscan civilization. But in Italy, the Pelasgi are a kind of mythological race. I mean, Herodotus, the Roman writer, said that the Pelasgi were the descendants of the Etruscans, the forefathers of the Etruscans.
Ah, all right.
So I started to look more into the Pelasgi, if you like, Pelasgians, and they seem to be some kind of seafaring race like the Phoenicians,
mm-hmm.
but they had tremendous skills in cutting and placing and moving and lifting stones. Because we know Baalbek was a Phoenician center in ancient times, and the Phoenicians were great stonemasons. Even the Bible states that Hiram, who built the Temple of Solomon, was a Phoenician. So it seems like the Phoenicians were the ancient stonemasons who went around passing over their skills or building their own ports, if you like.
Hmm.
And it is in Italy that we find the greatest polygonal walls. Are near the sea, near the ancient harbors, if you like. So, of course, also local folklore. I always listen to local folklore because, you know, there's often a clue to our history there. I don't dismiss it like many historians. And they do say that these polygonal walled cities were built by the Pelasgi, not the Etruscans.
Hmm.
But that was reinforced when I discovered this amazing city called Cossa. It's near Andonosia now, which is near Grosseto in Tuscany. Near the city of Grosseto, if you just go slightly to the south on the coast, you'll find a place called Andonosia. And near Andonosia, a small town, is this Roman, so-called Roman archaeological site called Cossa. That's C-O-S-A.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's no signs to this site, so you'd probably find yourself driving around for several hours. And then suddenly you'll find it up an old sort of track, and at the top of this track is a tiny little museum or an information center with a few of the finds from the site in there. But as soon as you step out your car and walk towards the site, you're faced with walls over 30 feet high, over 10 meters high, of these massive blocks of stone that are fitted together in the polygonal way, the polygonal fashion of masonry. They use no mortar, and all the stones are cut differently, different shapes, but fit together in a way you can't pass a blade through the joints.
Yes.
Now, this type of wall is basically indestructible, because if an earthquake hits a polygonal wall, it even tightens itself up because of the different shapes in it.
Right. It strengthens.
It's stronger. Because each stone is a different shape and has more than four sides. So these walls, when I saw them, blew me away. And I'd seen walls in Peru, maybe slightly larger in Peru, some like in the Sphinx Temple in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
But these had a unique character that was slightly different from the Egyptians and the Greeks. So I was quite fascinated with them. So walking around Cossa, it was obvious that the outer walls belonged to a much earlier race, because inside there were the classic Roman remains of rubble mortar and the typical sort of Etruscan walls, which are squared stones with sort of they have a skirt, like a lintel, that goes around the base of their buildings, which is half rounded. And you find this in all the Etruscan cities you go to. But what I found there at Cossa was a great example. I think I've shown it in the presentation, where you see a Roman wall of the classic type on top of an Etruscan wall, which has squared blocks with a curved stone. And underneath that, you have a polygonal wall.
Yeah.
So it's obvious that the Etruscans built on top of an earlier wall. So
and these might go back to the Pelasgi again, then, this original site,
right,
so to speak, the Cossa. And what time period do official people date the site to, and do you have differ in that timing?
I think this is a tricky one, because archaeologists can't date the walls because there's no mortar between the joints. I mean, with mortar you can date the time it was built, but because these stones are clean, there's no way to know exactly how old they are, but we can gather that they must be at least before the 10th century, before 1000 BC, because the Etruscans came along in the 9th century. So it's possible they could be late Bronze Age.
Or even older, right?
Or even older, as I say, because we can't date mortar, they could go back into the midst of time, because but there is another clue. You can tell by the amount of weathering on a stone, because some of the stones are very hard, what they call travertine limestone, which is basically rather like marble. It's very, very hard limestone. A lot of the walls around Cossa and others are travertine, And they haven't worn that that great. But the Etruscan and the Roman walls have weathered greatly. So it's difficult to say, really. But they could be Neolithic, but we don't know.
Yeah. Wow. That's.
But there's another theory. There's another theory that the Pelasgians taught this method of building to the Etruscans, because in other Etruscan towns, we find just these great polygonal walls with nothing underneath them. So, you know, it's still open, and we're still investigating it, because we have many, many more polygonal cities to visit.
Okay.
But as we're traveling, we're noticing there's a kind of a nucleus in central Italy between, if you like, the, let's say, between Tuscany and Naples. The central mountains along there are just littered with incredible polygonal cities that hardly anybody visits.
And are they usually high up, like in Cosa? It's a high up peak?
Well, Cosa is actually right next to the sea. That's why I believe it was a Pelasgian fortress, a Pelasgian harbour. But yes, the other polygonal walled cities are on the mountainous chain that runs through the backbone of Italy.
Mm.
And from some of the most magnificent are the ones that we actually visited last year, because I think the presentation you saw didn't include what we've already found in the past year. So I can tell you that we found some even more amazing cities.
Really?
South of Rome and north of Naples.
Mm-hmm.
There's one called Norcia. Now, this is a fascinating place, because it has a polygonal, half-rounded tower. So here we have not only the most magnificent stonework, but they've shaped it to make a round tower. Mm. So it's even more mind-blowing.
Wow.
So a
point here I'd like to bring up is that it seems to be that the more advanced architectural style comes from the ancient past, so to speak, and when we're moving up along into history, it's actually degrading in a way, right?
Yes.
Isn't that weird?
It is. It's as if, you know, the people were losing this gift to know how to cut and move stones, because I've had a lot of people emailing me theories about, oh, yes, you know, they could move stones and then through levitation and or anti-gravity devices. But then, you know, they don't explain, well, it's the cutting as well, because to place one stone on the other, it has to be almost cut precisely to the other one.
Yeah.
In other words, the only way I can think they did it is they took a quarry face, a wall of a quarry face, and they somehow cut it into all these shapes, like with a laser beam or something, which is impossible, by the way. And then they took all the stones down piece by piece and re-erected that wall again. That's the only way you could do it, because you couldn't have one great stone and then get a mason to start cutting it into shape and then dropping it in. Say, no, take it back up again, needs a bit more off the bottom.
Yeah.
You know, it just can't be done. Any stone mason looking at these walls will tell you that. But, of course, most people will look and think, well, you know, there must be an easy way, because people aren't really much aware of how to cut stone. They aren't stonemasons.
Yeah.
And I've met many stonemasons who are equally as baffled as to how they did this.
Do you think there could have been any kind of machinery, you know, used? Because there's other sites around the world that we can reference to this, like Puma Punku, for instance, or there's other places as well where it seems to be, there must have been some kind of advanced machinery or something.
Absolutely.
You know, what do you think?
I think there's an esoteric side to this, and there's a kind of scientific side. I mean, some people like to think that they had a method of softening stone,
yes,
so it could be cut easily, or even molding them using a kind of cement mixture that's set into looking exactly like stone. But then when you see particular veins and streaks in the stone, you know, that's obviously weren't cement. it was part of the natural geological layers. So, and I don't think they managed to soften the stone, because softening the stone will still make it difficult to lift and put into place, because we've got the weight ratio as well, with several tons of stone. Because some of these walls in Italy, you know, some of the largest ones are over 20 feet from the bottom, over 20 feet high, as if they're showing off, you know, that they could move any size or any weight, any place. Machinery, yeah, it's possible, but of course, you know, in ancient Egypt, there are even depictions of machines that, of course, never been found, because if they did discover how to make iron and steel and metal, then it's probably completely corroded away by now, and so there'll be no machines left. But I think, you know, the latest research from a lot of really great minds say that the Egyptians must have had some form of power to use power tools or cutting tools to cut through granite.
Yeah.
Because cutting granite is such a difficult thing to do, because granite naturally shatters when you hit it with a chisel. So you have to use vibratory tools to cut them. So otherwise, you know, the old idea is that they had copper saws that they put sand in the grooves and they kept cutting and cutting. To me, it doesn't make sense when you see some of the magnificent monuments. It's a bit too ridiculous.
Well, that's right. And I guess we can bring up as an example the unfinished obelisk in Aswan, right, in Egypt, which is very, very strange. And you know, how the heck did they do it? It seems to be one piece of stone and it's broken, so they've given up on it and say, let's move on to another place in the quarry and do a new one, pretty much, you know?
Exactly. I mean, it seems to me that they could do this easily, you know, and they could do it relatively quickly as well, because, you know, engineers have looked at the cutting ratio of the sort of grooves that go into the granite, and they've seen that this type of grooving can only be seen on really high-powered diamond saw cutters, you know, with several tons pressure on them. You wouldn't have those grooves with a copper saw, if you get what I mean.
Yeah.
You know, but people tend to ignore the experts. I don't know why. I think they like to keep the chronology. You know, let's have it right. You know, the Romans basically took over Europe and civilized us all.
Yeah, right.
And that
right.
seems to be the general sort of,
idea.
Mindset.
Yeah.
Idea.
Why do you think that they run with that? Why are the mainstream so obsessed with that idea that the Romans or maybe carrying on from the Grecians a little bit, then, that these guys are the founders of Western culture and civilization?
I think Rome has always had its hand over Europe, either through religion or through war power, you know, kings, bloodlines. It seemed that there was an agenda way back in time that to create a kind of United States of Europe with Rome at its center. I mean, these things are talked about probably by the Roman emperors themselves. But they never quite managed to achieve it. You know, today there's still an agenda to have this united Europe. And it has a lot to do with some of the old tribes and ancient wars that went on between certain races of people. But that's a huge story.
Yeah, I know. It's one we can maybe talk about later on, but there's not enough to talk about the Etruscans. And again, you mentioned the alphabet, for instance, which again, you showed some pictures of that in your presentation, which was interesting because to me, you said there are similarities to the runes, but there are also similarities between some of the, shall we say, Semitic languages or Phoenician styles as well, which we even derive our alphabet from today, the
absolutely.
Latin one. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. I think the Phoenicians, maybe the Pelasgians, were a branch of the Phoenicians. I'm certain of this because what the Pelasgians were good at, the Phoenicians were also good at. The Pelasgians are great stonemasons. They're very skilled at making intricate jewelry and metalwork. So are the Phoenicians. You know, when the Etruscans reached their height of power, they were able to fight off the might of the Greek navy. So the Etruscans were great seafarers as well. And where did they inherit that from? Because before that, they were just simple farmers.
Mm.
So suddenly they become not only a great race who built fantastic cities, but they had a fantastic naval fleet. And they amalgamated with the Carthaginians, who were another, if you like, the western branch of the Phoenicians. So I'm positive that the Pelasgi were related to the Phoenicians. Because basically, Phoenician means red-haired. I mean, it doesn't tell you who they are, it just describes them.
Yeah.
But the Pelasgian is an interesting word because, you know, Pel in the Eastern, sort of West European languages, would have, I mean, the letter P is interchangeable with B. So it may have had the sound of B and not P. So they may have been pronounced as Belastians, and we know that the word Bel was the ancient Sumerian word for the sun god.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Huh. So it's possible that these people, or Pelasgian, could actually translate to followers of the sun god Bel, or tribes of Bel. And they were Chaldeans, or worshippers of Bel. So the Pelasgian may be related to Chaldeans.
Huh.
It is said that the Chaldeans came as a separate race and built Stonehenge in England.
Yeah.
Because Stonehenge is completely different to any other structure, prehistoric structure in this country. Avebury and all the other stone circles were often built with uncut stones. It was almost forbidden to actually shape a stone. But when Stonehenge was built, they actually cut the faces flat on the inner side of the circle. So there was obviously a different race with a different religion that did this. And Stonehenge itself is completely different in style, having a sort of tenant mortise sort of roof lintels around, which may have supported, some people believe, a wooden roof for observing the stars. But traditions say that the Chaldeans came and into England and merged with the local megalithic peoples and developed Stonehenge, because there was other circles there before.
Yeah.
But the clue is here is that on one of the stones at Stonehenge is a pummeled axe carved into one of the stones. And archaeologists believe it's very ancient, probably thousands of years old. Well, this pummeled axe or dagger, sorry, it's not an axe, it's a dagger, pummeled dagger,
mm-hmm.
is exactly the same as those found in northern Etruria. Used by the Pelasgi and the Etruscans.
Wow. Hmm.
So, you know, I kept finding these sort of links with between our country and Etruria.
Yeah.
You know.
I never heard that before. That's very interesting. So it's just a small little carving of a dagger on one of the stones.
Small little carving near the foot of one of the stones at Stonehenge.
Yeah.
Showing it's a distinctive type of dagger because it has a pommeled handle, like a ball at the end of the the handle where you'd hold it.
Yeah.
There'd be a ball, and then a separate piece to shield the front of your hand, and then a small pointed blade.
Hmm.
And this is, you know, a particular style. It can be seen in Tuscan areas, and some believe, you know, this is the dagger of the Pelasgians.
Wow, that's really, really interesting. And before you mention the Pelasgi, and I guess carrying on from that, the Etruscan sense were seafarers, and that gives some clue or maybe even a little support to that, the theory of diffusionism, that there could have been communication going on between different continents, between, let's say, Europe and America or South America. What's your take on that? Do you think that might have been the case and that knowledge were shared across the world in ancient times?
Yes, I do. I've seen in South America and in Mexico the styles of masonry that's identical to Middle Eastern or Sumerian. And some of the tales and legends, which I love to study, talk about people coming over, these gods coming over in boats from the eastern lands, which from America would be, you know, Europe.
Yeah.
And they're always described as bearded gods, rather like the Greek people or the Etruscans, is where they've always fashioned a beard. Mm-hmm. And so,
which, by the way, sorry to cut you off there, but by the way, we always see in, if we look at kind of Assyrian renditions of the gods, so to speak, you always have these curly type beards on them as well, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think some people also imagine the old Atlanteans as being these great bearded people.
Yeah.
Because the Greeks would always depict their gods with beards. You know, and so forth, the Sumerians always showed their gods with beards. Mm. And it was something that the beards were sacred. And I think their leaders emulated them with growing their own beards.
Mm. And in some cases, it's interesting because you see beards pop up in regions where the local population, at least today and a little bit backward back in time, they don't have the ability to grow facial hair, you know.
Yes,
so
that's right.
So it gives away a clue that there's another people coming in there. And I mean, again, you mentioned the Atlantean theory there. Do you think that that's a possibility, that we had a central position or a central place where art, architecture, and the idea, I guess, of civilization spawned from or came from, and this, for whatever reason, has been, later on been scattered throughout the world, Gary?
Yes, I think so. I think there may have been more than one Atlantis, though, my feeling is. I mean, generally, people tend to think Atlantis is one great island where this great civilization came and sort of life evolved from this island to other places. But I think evidence shows for me that through archaeology, that man has been around in all over Europe and highly populated from, you know, 10,000 BC to now, you know, going back to 100,000 BC. So I think what Atlantis means more is that a highly developed civilization started on one island, and that, you know, their thinking was way beyond others, as if, you know, almost in a fictional way, an extraterrestrial race came to Earth and supplanted or seeded a race on one particular island that was ideal for life.
Mm.
And that, you know, these people then spread their culture to other parts of the world. And that's one analogy, if you like. Or, you know, maybe these people were just suddenly had great inspiration and became a fantastic civilization before anyone else.
Hmm. Well, Gary, why don't we talk a little bit more about that and many other things as we carry on here in the members section. I want to talk about your book, of course, The Spirit of Portland, in more detail after this break. But before we round things up, tell us briefly, we have about five minutes or so to wrap things up here. Tell us briefly about The Spirit of Portland, your book, and how people can get it. Mention your website and so forth as well.
Yeah. Yes, well, the Isle of Portland has a reputation for stone quarrying and its naval heritage. But I discovered that behind this lies an island steeped in myth and legend, because it was an important island that was very strategic in prehistoric times to the Phoenicians, who we've been talking about a little bit, because a lot of the place names on the island, some of the artifacts that have been found mysteriously in people's gardens, I've recognized as Phoenician or Etruscan. Some of the coffins that were found on the island were classic Etruscan. I mean, I've been to all the Etruscan sites. I've seen that a particular type of coffins or sarcophagi they used around the 4th, 5th century BC. And the ones that were found in Portland that are said to have been Roman are actually Etruscan. But because Portland supplies the stone for London to rebuild its crumbling white stone, which is made of Portland stone, the demand for quarrying in the island is great. And so there's very little really attention paid to it in an archaeological sense. So they kind of brush things under the carpet when it comes to exposing its early history. And its geographical position is so important. At one time, there was 7 stone circles on the island. And the island only measures 3 miles long, a mile and a half wide. So it's a very small island, but it was some kind of prehistoric center because it had many stone circles that have now been destroyed. So I went into the folklore and discovered some hidden manuscripts in the museum that revealed that these people were the island families came from very important sea peoples from different countries that settled together on the island by the kings of England to be isolated but kept for purposes to do with royalty. Their bloodline was very important to the royalty, and often some of their women were seeded into royalty to keep a kind of holy bloodline, if you like.
Yeah.
But what I also discovered on the island was that all the churches that were built by the Masons conformed to a plan of sacred geometry that of the Vesica Pisces or Pisces.
Right.
And this means that the Masons who built these churches, which were all around the Victorian period, placed the high altars of their churches equidistant to all the others around the island. And again, this is a knowledge that, to me, is also similar to the Phoenicians and who had these great skills, still going in the Victorian times.
Mm.
And I found, absolute proof of it, as anyone can get a map of Portland and see for themselves. And because it's so small, the accuracy is so great, it's provable. It has similarities to Bornholm off the coast of Denmark.
Uh-huh.
Because Bornholm also has churches that conform to a plan of sacred geometry.
Oh.
And I also discovered that the Jutes who settled on Portland were linked with the Jutes that may have lived on Bornholm. Because the surname White, in its Danish spelling, which is spelled H-V-I-D-E, were a very, very powerful family in Denmark around the time, the Norman times, Norman period, when the great Gothic cathedrals were being built. And they were Jutish from Jutland. And so we find on Portland today the White family still live there.
Really?
And they still maintain that they are descended from Jutes. So I found all these amazing links with Europe and ancient civilizations from this tiny little island off the coast of Dorset.
Huh. Wow, that's really interesting. Hey, Gary, I want to talk more about this later on here in our next segment. But for those who are interested and want to get a copy of your book or read more about it or read more about your other research, where do people go? Tell us about your website.
If people want to buy a copy of the book, which is on sale now, they can go to rovingpress.co.uk. Now that's rovingpress.co.uk. And there's a link there for them to buy online if they want to do so.
Roving Press. And then you have your personal website as well. Tell us what that is.
And my personal website at belinusline.com, belinusline.com. That basically is a website that's covering some of the work I'm actually going through at the moment, researching a route that goes through the spine of Britain from the Isle of Wight to the top of Scotland. But on that site is also information about the Spirit of Portland and other things and talks that I do, venues, etc.
Okay, very good. We will have these links up on redicecreations.com, so you can click through from our end and find more of Gary's work. That's our first segment with Gary Biltcliffe, and we have tons more of material to discuss in our second segment for Red Eyes members about cone-shaped pyramids in Greece and Italy, labyrinths in the Nordic countries, the seafaring people, diffusionism, and Atlantis in the north. We'll talk about cataclysms and out-of-place artifacts, the significance of Portland in the UK, about the sacred geometry layout of some of the churches there, the golden ratio, Vesica Pisces, a pentagonal castle, and the Stonehead found in Portland. We'll also talk about the relationship to the Danish island Bornholm, some of the similarities, and the family connection to the White or Vit family, and if these are related in any way to the Blondes or more Nordic-looking people who seem to have traveled around the world in ancient times, and we'll ask a question if there's any connection with the Aryans. We'll round things up to talk about a possible ET or ancient astronaut theory as well. So don't miss this exciting continuation with Gary Biltcliffe. Go to our website, click on Members to tune in, or on Subscribe to sign up and get instant access to our website, redicecreations.com, for much more. I also want to mention that we have some interesting programs upcoming. We are going to have Mike Barra with us soon, co-author of The Dark Mission with Richard Hoagland on moon anomalies. We have writer Henry Mackow coming up on the program talking about the Illuminati, the New World Order, Zionism, and the current situation in Canada related to hate laws and free speech. Next up on the program, we have Neil Kramer with an update from the Cleaver. I also want to mention that our scheduled program with Alfred Weber has been postponed to the end of July due to his upcoming trip over to Spain for the Exopolitics conference. But we are going to have him on at the end of July or possibly the beginning of August to talk about this very interesting topic of the NASA bombing of the moon in October this year and the exopolitical perspective on this. If there is an ET base on the moon, which have been suggested, this is indeed very, very interesting. And this dovetails very nicely with our program on Dark Mission with Mike Barra. So we are looking forward to these programs and our upcoming webcasts with Daniel Tatman and Michael Tessarian as well. Keep your eye on redicecreations.com. Okay, more with Gary coming up after this break.